From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
99 days until the Chicago municipal election.
Today, candidates for the top job in the city will begin filing their mayoral nominating petitions.
We've been out here since yesterday, 4 o'clock.
They come early because Joseph Williams and other candidates believe being listed at the top of the ballot gives them an election day advantage.
There is a little bit of political theater to this opening day of the candidate filing period. The candidates want to make a big deal of how many extra signatures they have collected above the bare minimum, flexing their political muscle as they look ahead to the February 26th election.
We have about 50,000 there, and we've secured signatures from all 50 wards.
I'm very grateful for all the volunteers who helped us get these 60,000 petitions, and I look forward, as I said, to an inclusive and an issue-based campaign.
8 days after being reelected as state comptroller, Susana Mendoza makes it official. She wants another job as Chicago's mayor.
This might be the only opportunity, it's really the first that we've ever had, perhaps, to have a mayor of Chicago who actually understands and loves the rest of the state.
Now that the election for governor is out of the way, candidates again filing paperwork, this time to be mayor of the state's biggest city. We heard there from the former state budget chief and Chicago Public Schools CEO Paul Vallis, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, and Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza, all of them running for the mayorship. We'll talk about that and some dark clouds for the state budget. More on State Week coming up. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and joining the panel today, Charlie Wheeler. Charlie is director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. In our State House Bureau, it's Brian Mackey, who is Illinois Public Radio State House Editor. And joining us by phone from Chicago today, Greg Hines. He's a blogger and columnist about politics and government for Crane Chicago Business. And Greg, it's good to have you on again.
Always a pleasure.
I'm going to start with the state government discussion here, because there was a report that came out from the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, and it had some pretty stark news when you look ahead to what could be ahead for the state's finances. Brian, fill us in on what this report had to say.
Yeah, despite all the governor and legislators proclaiming earlier this year what a great balanced budget they had passed, it turns out that is not going to be the case for the current budget year. Among other reasons, there's the sale of the Thompson Center, which has not happened yet. There is the attempt to change the pension laws so that people could take buyouts of their pension benefits. That was supposed to yield some savings, but the pension systems have been slow to implement that. At least one of them, a university system, says they're not even going to be able to implement that probably until the next budget year. And revenues have come in a little higher than expected, so that's actually a bright spot. But then there's this issue of the what are called step increases, these sort of longevity pay raises that members of the AFSCME union get, state employees get. And so that is going to be another expense added on. And so ultimately we're looking at a deficit in the current year of probably more than $1 billion, and that number is projected to grow from the governor's budget office, and that's going to add to the backlog of bills, too. This is absent any spending reductions or future tax increases, and, you know, it's within a few years, we're going to be worse than we were at the height of the budget impasse, according to these projections.
And Charlie, how is that possible? I'm sure there are people saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm paying more in taxes, the income tax went up, how can things get worse?
Well, the expectation from the Governor's Office of Management and Budget is that, yeah, our revenues will increase a little bit, but on the other hand, the expenses are going to go dramatically. And part of this forecast by the Governor's agency is predicated upon a pessimistic national outlook for the economy. They're anticipating basically that there will be a relatively mild recession that starts this coming spring and lasts all the way through the end of 2020. And if that were to occur, obviously the economy slows down. There are fewer wages being paid, so people are buying less stuff, paying less sales tax, paying less income tax. And at the same time, the expenses are going to go up, including in the area of pensions, where we're still, by law, committed to make increased payments into the 5 retirement systems every year. And so this forecast, I think, Brian, they don't even factor in the cost of the step increases, do they?
Well, it gets added to the walk down at the end. But yeah, it's that's where you go. If you take those out, they're looking at a $546 million deficit for this year. And that's where you take it above a billion if you add those step increases in.
Yeah, and I noticed that they predict at the end of the five-year period that the bill backlog is going to be roughly $24 billion. Now, I would be willing to bet any amount of money that is not going to happen because conditions will change. I'm assuming that there will be adjustments made in both spending and revenue when the new administration comes in. And so this is kind of a gloomy scenario, but that's all it is a projection based on current conditions without taking in a recession looming, without taking into account what kind of adjustments in policy might be made by the Pritzker administration and the legislative Democratic majorities.
Well, this gets put on the plate of the incoming governor, J.B. Pritzker. And, Greg, that's probably not the scenario he would most like to see.
No, it's not. The question with him is he going to solve it or is he going to make it worse? Is the Republicans basically are right when they say Democrats like to spend money? They do. J.B. Pritzker made a lot of promises, early childhood education, basic education. There's a lot of talk about a capital program. That all has to be paid for somehow, and the pension problem really hasn't been solved. So like it or not, job one for Mr. Pritzker when he gets down there is going to be try to come up with some kind of balance. I mean, my hunch is that he will do what almost every governor in the past 30 or 40 years has done. He'll come in and declare, oh, my goodness, I've looked at the books, and it's far worse than I thought. That no good Nick who was there before me screwed up things, so we're going to have to really go back to square one. But there's going to be a lot of truth to it this time. I'm not sure what he's going to do, how he's going to do it. He's backed off his promise to kind of go ahead with a graduated income tax light right away. But he needs to balance the books because the numbers are not very good.
So what is the likelihood? You know, he's got to put a budget together before the spring, and most likely, even if they give him a little bit of time, which they often will do for an incoming governor, he's got to come up with a spending plan for the next year. That's not a lot of time to work out these details, Brian. I mean, whether it's another tax increase of some sort, or he has a way to cut the budget in some way, he's really under the gun almost immediately.
He is, yeah. I mean, the budget address, I don't have the calendar in front of me, but it's typically in February. And this is something where, as Greg said, he's made a lot of promises. I think one thing we haven't mentioned is his sort of public option Medicaid light plan, where basically anybody in the state could buy into the state health insurance plan, is something else he's talked about. So a lot of expenses, various interest groups have tried to tally the figure. Some have put it at billions of dollars. And, how he gets there. And we need to remember that this centerpiece of his campaign, this moving to a progressive income tax or graduated income tax where you pay higher rates on higher levels of income, that can't go into effect until 2020 at the earliest. That's if the legislature approves it and if the voters approve it at at the next election.
And surely that would not solve this problem, right? I mean, that might be a partial solution, but how close to solving it would it get? I mean, how much could he reasonably raise by going that route?
Well, I think the estimates vary all over the ballpark. But if at the next general election in 2020, if voters were to approve an amendment to the revenue article of the Constitution, removing the language saying that income taxes have to be at a non-graduated rate, the earliest that they could actually implemented, I guess, would be like the day after the election in the lame duck session. And depending on how it's structured, it could raise a lot or not a whole lot. I mean, you could design it so that in a way it would be almost revenue neutral and take money from this new graduated income tax, the increment, and give it all to school districts and reduce property taxes. Or you could design it so it raises a lot of money.
There are a couple of revenue sources we probably should mention that I think have moved to the forefront. Legal recreational marijuana, I think, is coming here. Voters around the country have now started to authorize it. That happened in Michigan in the election. There's numbers of around $500 million a year that would bring in. That doesn't solve the problem, but it's certainly a nice down payment. I also think that there may be a real move toward expanded legalize gambling in the state early in the next session. Yeah, I know we talk about that almost every year, but there seem to be more interest than I've heard before. More people potentially who might go for it so they can lose a vote because the Democrats have bigger majorities. That will help a little bit, but it'll only buy some time. It doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah, and there was a report that came out from the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability a few weeks ago, their annual review of wagering in Illinois, and they cautioned people not to be too excited about expanding gaming. They've analyzed the proposals that have been on the table to add riverboats, to put a casino in Chicago, to maybe allow slot machines at racetracks. And their conclusion is you might get an initial big hit. You could get hundreds of millions of dollars selling a license to operate a casino in Chicago, for example. But on an ongoing basis, you're talking about only an increment of maybe tens of millions of dollars because there is such a plethora of gaming opportunities now with the video gaming terminals all over the place.
And Brian, when we talk about these types of revenue enhancements, sure, they could bring in maybe, you know, $1 billion or a couple of $1 billion. That brings that number down, that $5 billion that we're talking about. At the same time, if you go by what J.B. Pritzker has talked about as far as increasing spending in higher education or education, you know, K-12 or other areas of state government, it doesn't deal with that deficit. It basically could just help fund additional spending in the state.
Yeah, and to say nothing of doing something about property taxes, which he also said he wants to do. Yeah, this is going to be, if we haven't said it already, it's going to be a challenge to make his promises work with the amount of money you can get out of the system. If I can just piggyback off one thing Charlie said about the wagering in Illinois report and this issue of saturation, there are people I've talked to from the video gambling world who think that has gotten a bit out of control in terms of, you know, either entire, or not entire, but like mostly strip malls where you can have like maybe a bar and a restaurant and then two of these places, you know, Dottie's, Lucy's, they all have these women's names on them. And there's such saturation. I think that the number in that report was that there are the equivalent of 24 casinos worth of individual video gaming terminals spread across the state. So there are some communities, Springfield I think is among them, which still has the highest per capita video gambling terminals in the state, where there's a point of saturation and people in the industry think there will be some sort of shaking out and maybe consolidation in the future.
Yeah, and in kind of an anomaly, the one city that does not allow video gaming is the city of Chicago.
And that could always change, too, because The city of Chicago and some of its different local governments in the jurisdiction there have some problems as well. And, Greg, you wrote about one of those, the Chicago Park District's having some financial challenges.
Yeah, the Park District was the first major government, at least up in this part of the state that I'm aware of, to try to pass a negotiated compromise on pensions. They kind of sat down with their unions and they worked out a deal where the workers were going to pay more, the taxpayers were going to put in more, the benefits were going to go down, and over a relatively short period of time, we'd get back into balance. That did fine until the state passed somewhat similar legislation, went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. You're breaking a contract, and threw it out. The Park District's deal fell out in the meantime. So they have to go back to square one, and frankly, they've been kind of diddling around. They don't know what to do. The Park District's CEO this week, Mr. Kelly, in announcing his new budget, said, well, we're not going to deal with this in 2019, but by 2026, we're going to be insolvent if something doesn't change. We won't be able to pay the benefits. It'll have to come out of our operating budget. That would mean massive layoffs and service cuts. So in 2020 budget, we're going to have to deal with it. Typical election year kind of nonsense. That is not untypical of problems that are starting to face more and more governments at every level around the state. There's all kinds of towns and villages and cities that are having problems paying their police fire pensions now. The liability in the state funds continues to go up and up and up. It's somewhere past $130 billion in money we've promised we don't have right now. So that, too, goes on Mr. Pritzker's plate. He's talked about a pension obligation bond issue, but says it would be different than the one that passed under former Governor Blagojevich. We'll see. What we know is that until this pension problem gets solved, all the money that people want to spend on education and roads or whatever is kind of be already spoken for. We've got these pension debts.
I know there are people who are listening who are probably saying, now, wait a minute, J.B. Pritzker took a lot of money from unions. He had all this support from unions. Is he going to really do anything that changes the pension system in some way that brings that cost down? Anything that might anger unions? He has that line to walk as well.
That's a really good point. He has indicated, no, he doesn't want to cut the benefits that would have to do on the revenue side, but you're talking about a lot of revenue. One other idea that political conservatives throw out there is let's go back and try to amend the state constitution to legally remove this requirement that we pay all this money. Mr. Pritzker has said he doesn't want to do that either, but I hear a lot of talk from a lot of groups, including the Civic Federation up here, that this is something we need to consider. I don't think we've heard the last thing on that proposal yet.
The difficulties with removing the pension provision, you can't do it retroactively, and so you may take it out for future benefits, but the amount of money that we're spending, probably three-quarters of it, is going to pay not the costs of benefits earned in the given year, but rather it's going to make up for money that's not there because we didn't put enough in prior years, and the money that wasn't put in the funds wasn't earning any investment income.
I agree with you, but there's a legal argument that you could apply it to, for instance, salary increases that have not yet been earned. You would make those not pensionable or pensionable to a lower degree. The lawyers are going to fight over that.
And it's one of those things where I think that this is something where, you know, you're looking at the chessboard and thinking 18 moves ahead, that the successful effort to put Justice Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court and move that court more solidly into a conservative, fiscal, libertarian kind of Federalist Society mindset could be something where in the future, maybe the courts would look at the sort of contract argument with a different way than they have in the past.
So amid this backdrop of problems at the state and the local level, we have a mayor's race coming up in the city of Chicago, and sounds like just about everybody is going to run for mayor before it's all said and done. Greg, give us kind of the update on the filings as far as who's in at this point and maybe even who's out.
Well, I'm kind of waiting for Charlie to file his petitions. Come on, you can move, Charlie. I mean, we don't care if you live down there. About half of the potential field has filed at this point on the mayoral side, but there have been close to two dozen names mentioned. The real question isn't who actually files. The only person that I'm aware of who's dropped out is Trilo Riviere, a former Chicago public school principal who got in a big fight with Emanuel. The real problem is how many of those petitions are going to be good and have the qualified number of signatures. You need a minimum of 12,500, but this town is famous for challenging. Everybody challenges each other's petitions. You know, if the handwriting wasn't the right way, the guy left out his middle initial, he moved, he signed somebody else's petition. So the rule of thumb here is you'd need to have a bare minimum of twice the minimum to be safe, and probably three times. Three times is 36,000. Signatures. That's a lot of good signatures to get. There's a real question of how many of these folks have had the ability to do that. A lot of them don't have a lot of money. Very few people have a political organization now that you can count on. So when all the shouting is done and the lawyers are done and the challenges are done, we may end up with as few as five or six real candidates. Maybe we could end up with 14 or 15. Which of those numbers turns out to be true will determine a lot about how this race proceeds.
Well, the state controller, Susana Mendoza, had said all along that she was focused on running for re-election, and she wasn't thinking about the mayor's race of Chicago. It didn't take her long to switch her focus, though. Just a couple of days after the statewide election, she announced she's running for mayor of Chicago. Brian, is she one of the front runners?
Yeah, definitely. From everything I've heard and all appearances, she's got a decent name recognition. She has I guess it's an open question. The Speaker Madigan does not like to play in the Chicago mayoral primary, at least, but he is certainly been somebody who has helped her career or supported her career along. So, you know, there's that question as to whether he weighs in on this. And she has, seems to be out there in the top tier right now. And certainly, I think in 2018, or I guess it'll be 2019, in a city like Chicago, having a Latina surname is something that could be a boost as well.
Well, Greg, when we at the start of the show heard from Paul Vallis, we heard from Tony Preckwinkle, Mendoza as well. Downstaters who, they follow Chicago politics, but not maybe as closely because they don't live there. Those names they're probably somewhat familiar with. But is there anybody who's a dark horse candidate that seems to be making some waves and could really have a shot at this?
Frankly, there's so many people running that any handicapper who says they know what's going to happen is fibbing. Nobody does know. So the first question we have to answer is how many people are running. Then the question becomes, well, what are the lanes that they're running in? There's probably going to be a progressive lane that Preckwinkle is trying to occupy. Mendoza is trying to occupy that a little bit, too. Then there's a more conservative, more established lane that Bill Daley, the former Commerce Secretary, is in, and Mr. Vallis is in. Then there's an even more conservative lane that Gary McCarthy, the former police chief here, has. I mean, he's kind of the one Republican in the field. He doesn't want to admit it, but he is. He's appealing to the Trump vote, and yes, even in Chicago, there's a conservative Republican Trump vote. And in a big field, maybe 15 or 16 or 17% makes the runoff. That's all you have to do. So, again, depending on how many people actually make the ballot and what the logical lanes are, I think you may see some really targeted kinds of campaigns that could go for niche on the idea that if you have a smallish base, but if you really rub it up, that might get you the 16 or 17% you need. Mendoza has a little bit of a broader appeal. She has, frankly, has some appeal in all those groups, which is why I think most people indeed do put her on the short runners list. Preckwinkle has a little bit of that too, but she also has a lot of baggage from the soda pop tax here and some other things. But let's see. I'm not even going to try to forecast this until I know how many people make the ballot. Then we can try to figure out what's going to happen.
Well, one thing we know did happen, or I guess you could say did not happen, Chicago was trying for the Amazon headquarters, as were, it seems like, just about every city in the country, and the announcements did not go Chicago's way. They decided to choose locations out east, Virginia, and also at Long Island, New York. Brian, did we learn anything from that decision?
Yeah, well, I mean, Greg covered this more closely than I did, but I think it's interesting that, how many hundreds of cities across the country jump through these hoops, and shocking that the headquarters goes near where the CEO of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, has a couple of residences.
Shock.
Right? I mean, I don't think this is super surprising. I do think it's interesting that they decided not to go with an HQ2. They kind of went with, I don't know what you want to say, like an HQ 1.5 and 1.6 or something like that, because they're breaking themselves up. But they are near the political capital of the United States and the financial capital of the United States. So I don't know. You have a lot of cities probably going through hand-wringing right now about what could we have done? And you're going to have people trying to put political messages on this, like, well, if only we had done something about our pensions, if only this, that, or the other thing. Whereas it seems like this decision was probably wired to go the way it went from the beginning. But, it is an opportunity for self-reflection.
But I think there's also a school of thought that says maybe we dodged a bullet. When you look at the amount of money that's being pledged to these places, and you look at Foxconn up in Wisconsin, and you're offering these gifts to these companies that they're going to locate somewhere anyway, and you get in a bidding war, and in the long run, you may wind up losing money.
Greg, I know you. Greg, you covered this. So go ahead.
There is some truth to that, Charlie. Some of the numbers that are thrown around are truly sinful. But when the Foxconn numbers up in Wisconsin are beyond sinful, it's one of the reasons I think that Scott Walker, the governor there, lost his reelection bid. My impression here is that. There's probably some reason to think that it was always going to go, or it was going to go, but Chicago was pretty close to the top of the list. And what knocked us down the list, I think there's some reason to think, is that the people who run Amazon, Jeff Bezos, looked at the political leadership in Illinois and said, well, we don't have any confidence that the state knows what it's doing. And Mr. Emanuel, he's been better, but he would have our back, but he's not going to be here, and we don't know what the new mayor is going to do. Mm-hmm. I think that played into the thing, too. I should add, though, that despite the loss of Amazon, the city has done awful well in attracting some big companies in the last few years. There's a few more, I think, that are on the way. There's an announcement that's likely next week that involves several thousand jobs, which goes to Charlie's point that sometimes you need to forget about all the special subsidies and just sell the assets you have, your talent and your access to airport and whatever, and in a lot of cases that's enough.
And Brian, just a few seconds left here, but I did want to get in. We have some final tallies now on the legislature and what the makeup party-wise will be going forward.
Yeah, it's looking like the Democrats, we knew they were going to have supermajorities. The only question was, how big were those supermajorities going to be? And it's looking now like the House is going to have a 74-44 edge. That's three votes more than, over the supermajority. And on the Senate side, 40-19, Democrats to Republicans. So it's worth noting that one of the reasons the Democratic majorities are that big is that they do have some ideological diversity. You have some anti-tax people in there. You even still have some pro-gun people in the Democratic ranks. But there is more unity than there used to be, I think. And this is, one of the reasons that Democrats are excited about being able to try to work their will in state government over the next 2 years, at least.
Well, and to me, one of the fascinating things is that the House Democrats picked up 8 seats and lost 1. Of the 8 seats they picked up, 7 were in the suburbs, districts that traditionally elected Republicans. Their one loss was downstate, far southern Illinois. And it shows a shift in the political makeup of the state, where downstate is pretty safely Republican the further south that you get outside the Metro East area, whereas the suburbs, once the capital of Republicanism in Illinois, have now become pretty much Democratic.
Let's go down to our notes from the field. Greg, let's start with you.
Back to the mayoral race, in an interesting way, it's a blast from the past. We don't have any gazillionaires like Pritzker or Ron are running, and not even anybody like Rahm Emanuel who had the access to gazillionaires. We have mere millions of dollars being spent here, not tens of millions or hundreds of million dollars. I find that refreshing in a kind of a perverse sort of way.
All right, Brian.
The Illinois Supreme Court this week heard arguments in the first ever case to come before the Supreme Court on the state's biometric privacy law. This is said to be the toughest such law in the country. It makes it illegal to collect things like fingerprints, retina scans without user consent. The case revolves around a 14-year-old boy who had to give his thumbprint to get a season pass at Six Flags Great America on a class trip. And the issue here is whether this boy's family can sue in order to try and enforce that. They say this is the only way we have to enforce this law. The lawyers for Six Flags Great America say you really should have to prove some sort of harm. But the ACLU and other interest groups like that are saying that that argument would gut the law, and they're urging the Supreme Court to let this case go forward.
That will wrap it up for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Greg Hines. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.